Coming to you from the City of the Weird. Exploring topics from the esoteric and unexplored to dimensions unknown. Shining a light of truth on the darkest corners of our reality. Welcome to the Curious Realm.
Unmute that microphone. Happy Tuesday night, everybody. Hope you're doing well. I have been looking forward to tonight. In our second part, I am very excited to welcome back Chester Moore and Paul Fazinski. They are the makers, of course, of the Great White, the Gulf Coast Great Whites documentary that we had them on about. But they have a new documentary, the one that we were discussing with our good friend Lyle Blackburn a few weeks ago. He is in the documentary as well. This documentary is about possible lost tribes in Texas, the sightings that there have been of them. These are people that have been living out in the wild since the wild was wild. They have never come into society. They never went on to, the reservations or anything like that. So the concept of, are there lost tribes? Are there feral people living out in the wilds of East Texas, as has been rumored for a while? And they have some great reports that we're going to be getting into. And our first guest tonight, he has a new book. The new book is The Haunting of Emery Estate. We will be getting into that. We will be getting into some of his paranormal investigations that have happened recently, as well as animal spirits. Our friend Rob Gutro is back. We will be talking about these topics and other things. Welcome back to the show, Rob. How are you today, my friend?
I'm doing great. Thanks for having me. Good to be back.
Always great having you on the show. We always have fun conversation. And I especially love the fact we were talking before the show about literal animal spirits. And you have had a furry loved one lost recently. My wife had one. I guess it was actually, come to think of it, just before we had you on last time, we had lost our cat Leon. And it's been amazing to see, some of the characteristics of Leon that our other cat has picked up and taken on. He was not a lap cat. He was not a let me come snuggle in that kind of way cat until Leon passed. And it's been very interesting to see him kind of take up the mantle of the family cuddler amongst things. And it's interesting to see that, you know, growing up Catholic, Rob, it was very hard to accept the idea that animals have that kind of spark inside of them, that they have a soul, that they have a spirit that continues on after. But after years of study and other things, and even just experience, period, I have come to accept the fact that we are all an intelligent energy. And once that bell is rung, you can't unring it. You know, like it's a vibration that vibrates into eternity. Energy cannot be created or destroyed. It only changes form. You know, so how did you first come to the world of mediumship, Rob?
My first introduction was actually, a kind of shock when my grandfather, who died in December of 76, appeared to me live 77 when I was a kid. Scared me. I shelved that. My puppy, Buzz, I was killed tragically by a car in 2005. And then he just showed me how pets communicate. So that was his mission, as I learned about 10 years afterward. That was his mission. That's why he lived a short life. I've been able to, as you know, I've been able to keep around the world, right? I just did a reading with somebody in South Africa.
Wow. And, you know, that brings up an interesting point, which is, do you have to physically be with somebody in order to read them or in order to give them a reading in that kind of way?
Yeah, no, all I require is a photograph of pet and the pet's name and any questions that they may have. And usually before I even look at the questions, the pet gives me a lot of information, like things that they saw, things that they experienced, people around them, favorite memories or something like that. And then by the time I get down to the questions, most of the questions have already been answered, right?
Sure, sure. And now, granted, I do a little bit of remote viewing. I am by no means medium or psychic in that kind of way, anything like that. But it's always fascinated me the way that impressions with remote viewing come in, and the ways in which the subconscious mind cues and comes into that. How is that bridge built? I mean, between a human spirit and you, but also between an animal spirit and you. Is it cognate, so to speak, where, you know, no means no in Spanish and English? How does that translate to you? How do you pick up the impressions from an animal spirit as opposed to a human spirit?
Actually, much in the same way. So animals, if you think about how animals learn in the house, they learn our emotions, they learn our language, you know, they know what a lot of words mean, they know tea, they know different places in the house,
yeah.
They know when it's time to go out, they know when it's time to go. So what they do is they can actually convey that to me as an image or convey the word. Because it's like it's just repeating. So,
okay.
I'll give you an example. Another reading I did for someone in South Africa earlier this summer. It was about a dog, and the dog came through and it kept making my eye feel sticky and something wrong with my eye, left eye. And, I knew that there was some problem that he was trying to convey. And then he said a word to me that I had never heard before. And he spelled it out, the help of a human side. It was O-O-I-N-G-W-A-Y. And I'm thinking, what in the world is that? What is that nonsense word? So when I stopped for a minute and I went back and I reread the email, and they said it was South Africa. So I went and I looked up at languages in South Africa, and it said Afrikaans is a language that is spoken in South Africa.
Yep.
And when I typed it in translator, own word means eye opening. So that's where the dog's problem was. She's in the opening eye. So I learned a word in Afrikaans from a dog halfway around the world.
Interesting. Interesting. And like you said, the dog actively spelled out the word for you. So the idea that, once again, they know our language, and that's something that, there's two sides of that have fascinated me. Number one was spending time abroad in my late teens, for a whole semester taking Italian and finding out that animals make different sounds in other languages. Now, like, I had taken Spanish before, things like that, but we'd never really learned, like, oof for a dog, things like that. So the idea that, A, the sound of an animal is not a cognate across the globe. It's not a word or a sound or an utterance that the moo of a cow is not a moo in Chinese. It's not a moo in Italian. The cows say something else to them. So there's that, but also the fact of it doesn't really matter the language, animals understand it. And that to me is even more fascinating. Go ahead, please.
Yeah, no, they also convey a lot of things through emotion. That's a lot of the way that I see messaging.
Okay. Okay. And how do you kind of, what is your process of decoding that emotion into, I guess, human language, into understanding something else?
Well, these are the same emotions that we, really, that's my, what I, like, I have some cats that keep telling, that have kept telling me that they hate the pet carrier, they hate it, which is that, and one of the pet parents that I sent this to said, yeah, we knew that it's an anxiety, and we hate it that much, but they did. they love certain different types of routines and so forth. So it, I can feel when I'm talking to the pet, telepathically, and they're conveying these things, they're also sharing their emotions. So those are energy.
Okay. And is this something that you can do with living animals as well as those that have passed?
Only my dogs. So, no. So, that, to me, that would be an animal.
Okay.
I'm only a pet medium, so I can only connect with that pass.
Okay. And you know, let's follow that rabbit hole. No pun intended. But with that in mind, you know, are there other animals, other pets? Is it just higher order pets, cats, dogs, horses, things like that? Or if my son's pet lizard dies, would you be able to communicate with it? Is there a limit range wise?
Yeah. So yeah, I've done cats, dogs, horses, rabbits, ferrets,
okay,
rats, gerbils. they can all convey something.
Okay.
You know, the smaller they are, the less they can see or process.
Yeah, yeah. I was going to say, especially in that higher order kind of way.
Yeah, so, I draw the line at spiders and snakes because they kind of freak me out.
they personally oog you. So, yes. But not that you couldn't.
I probably could, if I could get through my fear of them, sure.
Okay. Okay. How about a turtle?
Oh, probably. Yeah.
Okay.
They can, turtle wouldn't have much to say, but sure, but.
Yeah, yeah. And once again, that comes down to the higher order thinking. You don't necessarily play fetch with turtles. They don't really respond to name in that kind of way.
Right.
You know, so, and that's just coming from a turtle owner. Don't get me wrong. Like, my turtle was pretty smart. He did some cool stuff, but he's not as smart as my cat that, like, played fetch. Or I would be like, hey, where's your bunny friend? And he would go get his pet animal and bring it to me. You know, stuff like that. So at what point does somebody typically call you to communicate with their pet, Rob?
Oh, gosh. Well, it's usually within a week or two after their pet passes.
Okay.
It's just like people, you know, we're in deep grief, and the first thing we want to know is if they're okay and what they're doing and so forth. So it's usually then. Sometimes people will actually connect with me and say, oh, I have this childhood pet that passed away. I've always loved them. I just want to. So. It depends on the person.
Okay. And does gapped time like that make a difference with your connection or the quality of connection that you have with the past animal?
No, so it doesn't matter how long they've been on the
planet. Okay.
Because time is really not a thing on the other side. It's only in the physical world.
Yeah.
So for pets who have passed 20 years ago, it's really like they just passed recently. So.
Okay. And that's something that we bring up on the show regularly, especially whenever it comes to things like this, things, especially with the world of remote viewing, that kind of thing. Like time is a construct that we have given things. You go to the moon, you need a different watch to tell time, because time is gravity dependent all kinds of things. Like, it is literally relative to the observer. That's actual physics.
I often tell people that if you're on Saturn, 1 year on Saturn is 29 Earth years.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Exactly. You know, and not just that, but it's passing slower, because of gravity. So yeah, it's fascinating to think about that and to think that only we have that concept of time. Which really makes a lot of sense whenever you get into some of the behaviors of our furry friends. Like our beloved cat, Floyd. I love him. He's a great cat. He was the one I was telling you about that, you know, just like picked up the cuddling habits of our old cat, Leon, that passed about a year ago. But it's interesting how, he doesn't realize how long Dad is gone sometimes. But he definitely knows when Dad's going, because he sees gear pile up in places that it normally isn't. He sees a suitcase pop out, and suddenly he needs to use the restroom in the den instead of his box, to make his presence known, and just so he gets a little extra attention before Dad leaves. But
one of our dogs, Chris, gets really mad when they know that we're going out. Really angry.
Yeah. And that's just it. Like the Leon used to literally come and lay in my suitcase while I would prep things. Like he knew what was going on. And it's interesting to see that, but it's also good to know that because they don't have that passage of time the same way we do, it doesn't mentally affect them heartache wise in the same kind of way. That longing for somebody in such a long-term way isn't necessarily there. Now granted, your dog will absolutely be reminded of your absence when it comes time for the leash, when it comes time for morning treats or whatever routine is typically there. You know, like they are fully aware, no different than Floyd is fully aware that, like, wow, only Mom gave me water today. Where's Dad's water? Cause he comes and begs for water from the sink from us. So, you know, it's like guaranteed he realizes at that point, like, hey, wait a minute. Dad's faucet in the bathroom didn't turn on this morning. Where's Dad? So at that point he probably has the realization again, but the long-term longing like my son experiences or like my wife, is not necessarily there in that kind of way because they don't experience time in the same kind of way that we do as dependent upon time. And that kind of, I think, swings us into the concept of ghosts and spirits and time to begin with, Rob. For you, especially as a medium, what is the difference between a ghost or a spirit? Is there a difference for you?
Yeah, for me, so that was actually the foundation of my first book. I call it Ghosts and Spirits Explained. And because I struggled with trying to understand why they weren't the same. So spirits, in my definition, spirits are the ones who have crossed over. Like my dad. My dad died in 2008. Yeah. My dad came back and helped me prove to my mother and her brothers that he would make his own girl in a handkerchief. So, as a key. But that's a long story. But then I ran into earthbound ghosts. I ran into people who were stuck in places, decided to stay in places. I wound up living in a house that was haunted, but I went back to college for another degree. And I thought that the ghost was outside, but the ghost was inside. And I wondered why this ghost, this earthbound one, not cross over and achieve peace. Instead, they were looking for help. So my definition is a ghost or earthbound at a fixed location of their choosing or where they die. And that can be like hospitals, prisons, sure, homes that they, and so forth. Spirits can come to us anywhere, anytime, anywhere. Like spirits of our grandparents, or my dad, my mom.
Yeah.
They visited me on vacation. And
Yeah, and that, of course, leads to where hauntings come from, things like that, and the fact that hauntings are typically not associated with spirits in that kind of way, because spirits are, once again, returning for purpose, so to speak. Like, they have a reason. Either they have come to give you a message, they've come to guide you in some way, come to protect you in some way. But ghosts, on the other hand, are the ones that are kind of playing the loop, so to speak. And that could be, that loop could be in a place, like you said, a place that they loved, a place that was traumatic for them. How do you go about connecting with a ghost, Rob?
Usually they reach out to me. Okay. If they want to communicate with me. I always tell people that when you go on a paranormal investigation, if you have two different, usually I go in with somebody else who says it. One ghost may talk to me and the other, and vice versa. It all depends on the personality. So it's just like going into a crowded room and you see a whole bunch of people there. You're attracted to the energy of one person. You want to go say hello. And then conversely, you see somebody else and you're like, I'm not going anywhere near. So you're reading their energy. That's what you're doing. So they decide.
Okay. Okay. And with that thought in mind, especially the fact of they are reading us, at what point does one of the questions I've always asked people is, should you be asking every ghost that you come across to go to the light? You know, are they all looking for relief or release in that kind of way? Even ghosts who may not know that, like, they are living this loop.
Sure. All I do is I offer the choice. And crossing them over, and I've done quite a number of crossings, like, especially like, takes a lot of energy. But you have to be a salesperson to a dead person that you, and you have to say, look, you don't know me, but the other side is peaceful and it's calm and it's full of love and you can see all your relatives as a spirit. But here, if you stay as an earthbound ghost, you're stuck. You're stuck, yeah. Man, until somebody sends you. So you have to sell it. And you sell it for two reasons. Number one, because you want to bring this ghost to us. And number two, you want to bring the living people. They live in the house and have that ghost there. You want to bring them peace. So it's kind of a win-win as you get them. So.
And, you said at the beginning of this that they come to you. How does that impression normally come through to you, especially if it's one that the difference between one that needs help, one that doesn't, especially?
So the one that doesn't want help interacts. Okay. Unless they're angry about something. And usually when I'm in the presence of an earthbound ghost, I get a headache. My theory is that the energy kind of overloads the energy in my brain.
Sure.
So I get headaches. And I know other people also have reported headaches. And then I try to understand, I'll ask them telepath or out loud. What's your name? Why are you here? Is there anything I can help you do? Story, et cetera, et cetera. And sometimes they'll share and sometimes they won't.
Okay. And for those that won't, especially, is there, of course you hear of instances in investigations, all kinds of things where people have, I've personally been on investigation and had like pennies thrown at us at a local bar that we were investigating, things like that. Is that necessarily a violent action or reaction, or is that like a possibly an attempt just to, hey, you look over here, you know, that, I guess that's, do some ghosts have full ill intent in that kind of way, as far as wanting to harm the living.
Yeah, sure. It depends on their personality. So I always tell people that they were nice when they're alive, they're likely going to be nice when they're dead. They're jerk when they're alive. They're a jerk when they're dead. Because when they become a ghost, they just stay earthbound. They don't learn anything when they transition to an earthbound ghost. Mm. Only when they transition to spirit do they have an awakening that their behavior on earth was bad, and then they try to amend it. And that's why when people medium, and they do read certain people that pass away, like loved ones. Some loved ones will come through and say, oh, I need your for this or that. My own aunt did that. She crossed over, she kept begging my mother. And finally, my mother forgave her. But that's because my aunt had crossed over, she developed an awakening that she did were hurtful for my mom. Ghosts don't have that.
Okay. Now, when it comes to spirits, how do you normally connect with those? Is it a different sensation than the headache, like you were saying, that you experienced in the presence of earthbound ghosts?
It's typically the same. It's about energy. So okay. It's an energy overload. And spirits will only come around, in my experience, around birthdays, anniversaries, and holidays. Anniversaries of their passing, wedding anniversaries, or something like that. So that's when spirits are loved ones. And that includes pets as well as people. Whereas ghosts are just always there in that particular location.
Okay. And you know, once again, that crossing back over for a spirit is an actual conscious decision in that kind of, I mean, I guess as conscious is when you don't have a physical body anymore. That brings up, that's a totally different debate and episode as to whether that is consciousness at that point or you are just pure energy. Can you speak to that in any way, Rob?
They all are energy. So, sure. Whenever they want something, let us know. They'll come through. So for instance, I was on a vacation I took a biking trip years ago, and I kept feeling that my mother was lost. My mother had never been to Europe. She's Italian. She'd never been to Europe though. And I knew she always wanted to see Europe, but she was always afraid to fly. So, I kept sensing that she was with us on vacation, and I said, you know, she's going to let me know that she's here. So we had to take a bus from where the ship docked, and we had to go to the town of Passau, Germany. And on the way, there was a huge sign for a supermarket with an Italian name on it, my mother's name, Norma. That was an Italian name is a supermarket in Germany. And I knew it couldn't be any more blunt than the sign with her.
Wow. That is wild. And, you know, the connection of things like that, just the sheer synchronicities to begin with. I don't know where I stand on synchronicities, and I'm somebody that doesn't really believe that things of chance are out there in that kind of way. I think most things happen for some kind of reason if you're actively looking for that reason. We have a much greater influence in the world around us than we like to think. And, you know, we just passed Halloween, Rob.
Yes.
That is one of the times of year that many faiths, religions, specifically Wicca, things like that, believe that the quote veil is thinner. To ask a question from your statement a minute ago, is it the fact that the veil is thinner during those times of year, or is it the fact that we're happily celebrating something, whether it be Samhain, Samhain, Halloween, whatever? Is it the fact that we are having a joyous time and celebrating? Or is it the fact that there are times where that veil is thinner. You know, the Dia de los Muertos concept of making the altars to family members and putting their pictures on it and bringing gifts to them, that kind of stuff. How do those things affect the connection?
Yeah, that's a good point. And I think it's because that those are the times when wants more to connect to people past. So the intention has to be there. It's just like when I went on this investigation, this Haunting of Everett Estate investigation, we had 20 members of the board. And they were broken up into three different groups. In one of the groups, there were people, there were two or four people that were, highly skeptical. They didn't believe one thing. And because they were highly skeptical, whenever that group came into our room, all of a sudden the messages stopped. The messages from the ghosts that we were communicating with in the 3 hours before. So their negative energy, their negative mindset blocked things. During Halloween and Day of the Dead, the people that partake in those celebrations are looking to communicate. They're more open-minded. And open-minded is really a part of communicating with the other side.
Well, and I would absolutely believe that to be the case, that you've got to be open-minded in order to even connect with that kind of, even as somebody who practiced ecstatic prayer and things like that at one point, like, you've got to be open-minded enough that you have a direct channel with the divine to begin with, to be able to feel that pull, you know, and it can be hard for us. How hard is it to, once again, sell those that have passed on the belief of such things? Have you ever come across the fact of there's just an obstinate ghost that does not believe in crossing over?
Oh, sure. Yeah. I'm going to bring up the Emperor to say again, because there was one of three that wasn't interested because so feared other side because of the transgressions that he apparently committed his life. And he believed that if he crossed over, he would go to a fiery place. Although spirits always tell me that fiery place is just the love on the other side, three levels and so forth. So there would be no convincing this particular ghost of crossing over.
Well, and that brings up, I think, a pin cushion of a point is the only way to put it, because there's a lot of points in the question I'm about to ask, Rob. Is there a fiery place? You know, have you ever come across a ghost that, or even spirit, that has come back from that side of things? Is there only the side of the light and the tunnel of light, or is there a darker, more sinister place that you can take a trip to in that kind of way?
So in all of the spirits I've committed, all of the investigations I've been on, none of them have ever conveyed such a fiery place. Now, I grew up Catholic, so I'm an ex-Catholic.
Former Catholic seminarian, my friend.
All I heard about was hell. You're going to hell for this.
Yeah.
Hell
for yeah.
And so in my opinion, hell is really being trapped as an earthbound ghost because you can't communicate with anyone.
Yeah.
You are stuck in the same place. You can't see your relatives. It's like being in an isolation prison. So to me, that's hell for eternity.
Yeah.
Yes, all of the spirits I've been dealing with have said that there is no bad place, but there are three levels on the other side. Some cultures that say there are seven.
Sure.
Well, but my aunt, who came back from asking, she told me she was on the lowest level. And she couldn't get up to the second level until she got that prediction from my mom. So that's how, you know, that's one of the reasons I know. So, and there are people who have done terrible things terrible things in life. I connected to one father, who told me he was physically and sexually abusive of his daughter. His daughter was an adult daughter, wrote me and asked me. And I didn't know anything about it.
Wow.
But all of this came through in the reading. And I was hesitant to actually share this with the adult daughter because it's all by email. I don't know where she lived or her last name. So long story short, she confirmed everything. And I felt so, I don't know, violated. I felt dirty. I felt sick. I was so sad for this, that she endured that from her father, who was begging me to get forgiveness from his daughter. And that's when I decided I am not going to spirit readings for people. And that was the line. I said only now on cats. Because people have too many angers. And you know, I just want to talk about love, dogs and cats and rabbits.
And I was going to ask, how do you even begin to broach that topic? Because that's tough enough for a therapist to begin with if somebody comes forth with it. But she isn't the one that came forth with it. So is the permission there to have the conversation in that kind of way? Like, how does that's a rough concept to bring forward as a, now don't get me wrong, sadly and horribly, Rob, an incredibly confirmative. You know, that's one of those where, like, there's empirical at that point, because her reaction's going to let you know whether or not you read that spirit right.
Yeah. I mean, all she did was send me his picture, tell me his name, and say, you know, what does my dad have to say to me?
Wow.
And I'm like, okay. And that was it. And that's all I got. And then all these horrible things came out. And writing that down on email, the email or reading, that was hard.
Yeah. And what was her reaction, if you don't mind me asking?
Oh, she acknowledged everything.
Wow.
She said, that's, you know, I was hoping that I would hear forgiveness from him, you know, asking me. And she said, and then she wrote me a long email and said, you know, I've been going to therapy.
Yeah.
Many years and trying to deal with this, but I needed to know that he understood what he did wrong. And I said, okay, well, I'm glad I could confirm that.
Yeah, honestly, what a beautiful point of relief for her, to not be suffering with that quandary anymore as to whether or not her dad even reciprocally had the wherewithal to say I had done wrong. You know, so that was beautiful of her to be able to understand that and to be able to accept that.
So I send people to other mediums.
I was going to say, like, I could also see after situations like that why you may just want to read animals. because, yeah, that gets thick quick. And that brings us to the world of hauntings and something that I tend to ask most medium psychics. The closest thing that I would say I am is maybe empathic to a tilt. You know, there were definitely, like, I excelled at finding the kid in the crowd who needed help when I was a youth minister, things like that. And just being able to read that energy off people.
But
it's one that, like, honestly, hey, like, much like you stepped away from reading people, the only way I could cut it off, sadly, Rob, was hard drugs. And I chose that route at one point, and it's been very hard to claw my way back to feeling empathy, to being able to reconnect in that kind of way, because it's still very much a raw nerve. And there are times where I get overwhelmed entirely too quick, and I get short in the world. And it was, I truly believe, because of my want to disconnect from that gift, my want to step away from that. So how do you cut off? Are you off? you will get into the recent haunting that you got to experience while doing a book signing as well. Do you have to open yourself for these things to come in, or do they just come in?
Oh, they just come in. and that became painfully clear when I went on vacation. When I went to England, I went on vacation to England to enjoy the history and, the country and so forth. I had no thoughts of connecting to a ghost. I had no interest in connecting to a ghost.
Mm.
But, fortunately, I take a journal with me wherever I go.
Awesome.
It doesn't matter if it's in the U.S. or overseas or, and I write things out. And I ran into so many different ghosts in England that wanted to tell their story and get help or not. And that became, this is my book, Sitting on a Vacation. Same thing when I went to Ireland. When I went to Italy, though, I will tell you that I had impacted sinuses and I was very sick and I could not get any messages from anyone. So,
wow.
Even though I was feeling miserable, I did get to enjoy the country without
interruption. Right. Literally. And that's something that I ask very, very skilled remote viewers, something that I ask psychics, something that I ask mediums, all kinds of things is, can you cut it off or is it just on? And you've just learned to put up a veil and be like, yeah, not right now, dude. I'm having coffee at the mall. You know,
I have had to do that. Yeah, I have. But so it's different when you're on vacation, though, because you're like, ah, I'm not even there. And then suddenly you're like, hello, my name is William. I'm like, oh, good for you.
Yeah. Now, and once again, is it the fact that, like, doesn't matter where you are, like, walking down the grocery store aisle, somebody will say hi from the other side?
Sometimes when I'm focused on a task, it acts like a block that I kind of tune them out.
Yeah, yeah.
It's just like doing the universe. So when I'm focused on communicating with a pet, I tend to block anything else out. Every now and then somebody else will get through, like when I was doing one reading and then it turned out to be a cat that was going to be my next reading, knocked some books over in my bookcase. And I'm like, what was that? and there's no reading there. And I knew it was a cat because they sensed the cat near me. Mm. Why did you do that? And the cat's telling me, oh, this is what I used to do at home. I used to like to knock things over and, jump up on bookcases and stuff. Okay, I knew it's coming.
And
my books alone.
Well, and like we were just saying a second ago, like you told me before the show, you had one of these situations just randomly pop up at a book signing that you were doing not too long ago where it randomly led to an investigation. How did that come about? How did that turn out?
So the thing was about, so we went to a book signing for The Haunting of Emery Estate, and it was actually kind of, it was pre-planned to do an investigation because the woman that manages the Hunt Memorial Library in Ashford, New Hampshire is somewhat sensitive and she's somewhat empathic, and she said that she's sure that there are ghosts there. So what happened was, she said, if you want to do an investigation and invite like 20 members of the public in there, you can do that after the book signing. And that's what we did. And we were able to figure out who the ghosts were, and there were three of them, that she has been feeling or sensing over the years working there. That book comes out January 1.
Epic. Epic. And once again, you are more than prolific. With the writing, you have numerous books on all of these topics.
Yeah, 13.
wow. And you know, with that in mind, Rob, how do you go about? Have you started passing this information on to other people? Have you taken anybody under your wing, found another medium that is on the same path as you, as far as, you know, listening more to pets than people, that kind of stuff?
I haven't really. I've run into an animal community, and she's the one that deals with live animals. She can also sometimes connect to animals that pass. So yeah, she and I have a really good relationship, and we've gone back and forth. I recommend her. I can find out why they're showing attitude, not eating, aging with another. So yeah. But the reason I wrote the books was so that people don't need me. All you need to do is read the books, and they will teach you all the different signs to look for. How pets can manipulate electricity, how they lead you to another pet that looks like them, how you may see your shadow, how you may feel that a nuzzle you on the leg under the table at dinner time, how you may feel a cat walk across the end of your bed or against your head. So all of these different things, and they can manipulate electricity to, in one particular story, a dog has got the help of a human to help manipulate something on the internet so that their pet parent would see them whenever they happen to scroll on one particular thing. So it was just bizarre. So I try to teach the world, really, so that people who read these books can teach others who also. So they don't need a medium. They really don't.
Well, and that brings up, I think, a very important question, Rob. A lot of this show, there's a lot of shows out there that rabbit hole on these topics that will advise all kinds of things. I am of the mind that we need to filter the water next to all the rabbit holes in the pond so that we can all drink from the water again. Cause the well is pretty nasty in most of these communities. And when you come to, especially the world of psychic and mediumship, man, since the days of Madame Blavatsky, there have been people like Harry Houdini out there debunking spiritualists and people who say they connect with the other side, all kinds of things, Rob. How do you caveat this topic for people? How do you help educate people to how to choose a good ethical medium? Because there are so many out there that are not ethical many of these communities. I mean, even in tarot card reading, there are unethical people. So how do you advise people if they are going to go to a medium, somebody other than you even, like you said, you have mediums that you recommend for person readings because you don't really do that anymore. How do you vet those people?
Just one.
Well, just hey, one. But even so that, I'm sure is a very specialized vetting process as far as what you're looking for.
So this particular medium, her name is Ruth Lark, and she's the big time Boston. And so she's a personal friend of mine. And she and I have been to different places. We've encountered the same ghosts, earned things for each other. She's extremely sensitive to children, lost children. She actually was rated one of the top 100 medium psychics in the U.S. in a book. But she's been a personal friend of mine for 20 years. And she's the only one I recommend. So, I mean, I know there are a lot of other really talented mediums out there, but I need to be able to work with them.
Sure. Sure.
In order to recommend somebody.
Right? Yeah.
I'm not going to just recommend somebody because I know them and I like them. It's important to set up. So,
well, and what are some of the red flags that people should be looking for as they contact a medium? What are some of the things that even for you, as a sensitive and a medium in that kind of way, what are the red flags for you that are more like flares when they pop up?
Oh gosh. I don't know. When they start asking too many personal questions.
Okay.
Like, what city do you live in? Anything specific. So when I do reads, I ask people if they live in the US or not. That's it. Because sometimes pets will come through with different languages. Another one just gave me a question. That was 2 weeks ago. And I don't know. But when they start asking too many personal details, you know, there are too many people out there that will try to take it from others in their grief, which is just a horrible thing. And they'll, you know, somebody said to me, I'm a skeptic, and I think that they're going to go on the internet and find a Facebook page. And I'm like, I don't do that. I don't want to know your last name. I don't want to know where you're I don't want to know anything about you. All I want to know is your first name and your dog's name and questions you have. So when they start asking too many details before they do, that's a big.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's just it. And a lot of that comes from, people love to talk. You may think that you're just answering a simple question. But unless you're just answering it as a yes or like Houston and that's it. Somebody could draw all kinds of information out of an elongated answer or out of even a series of answers back to back. That's literally some of how cold reading, things like that are done, you know, is
it's the same way when I go to get like Emory Estate, it's more the Lindell Manor. Book I just put out last month. I don't want to know anything about it. It's the same thing. Good people who are legitimate don't want anything, any information that influence their reading. So when I went to Lindell Manor, I knew nothing about it. And then I reconnected with about 10 ghosts and then found out that these ghosts all either live there, work there, or something. Same thing with Emory Estate. I didn't know anything about Emory Estate. I had never even heard of it, as a matter of fact. And I grew up in the town next to it.
Oh wow.
Believe it or not. But I didn't know anything about it. I didn't want to. And then it turned out that one of the ghosts, the one with the nasty attitude, is one of the people that actually lived there.
Wow.
So, yeah.
Now, we've got you for about another 5 minutes or so,
okay.
Rob. What has been the most personal? You of course had the reading from the lady and her father, but what's been the most personal and poignant experience you have had reading animal spirits?
Getting messages from my own dogs.
Oh, wow.
I have 5 dogs in spirit. And, as we talked about before the show, my dog Tyler just passed away on July 29th. And it's hard. It's really hard. We found out he had cancer, on July 25th. And then 4 days later,
wow.
It's gone.
Wow.
He lost all function of his body. And it was total shock. But when he started to come through, I was, sorry.
Never apologize on this show for being human, Rob.
Yeah. it was a big move when he started coming through. And, I had a dream of him. And that was the first thing. So dreams are the easiest way to experience him for me.
Okay.
And the dream was, it was short, but it was great. I dreamed that I walked in an old bakery, wooden floors, wooden ceiling, and probably a bakery called dessert. And around one of the tables came my dog Dolly, which is one of these up in here and on the cover of my book, and Franklin, the other dachshund, and behind him came Tyler. And that just meant the world to me, and I remember getting choked up. And I woke right up. And that told me that he was okay, and Dolly and Franklin. that's just one of the many different sides. But I know I only have a minute.
No, that's okay. Take your time.
Another one was our dog. I told you about our dog Dash. She's 17 years old. He's 90% blind. Almost deaf. He used to follow Tyler around everywhere. When we have little forest paths in our backyard, a week after Tyler passed away, Dash, who can't see, really, walked over to the path, walked all the way down the path, and I walked behind him. I'm like, how is he staying in the lines? He walked all the way down the end of the path, walked to Tyler's memorial that we put up, walked to the end, turned around, followed the road, and then came all the way back by himself. And I know he was following Tyler, because that's what he used to do.
Wow.
Yeah.
That is phenomenal. And you know, especially the dream. That I don't think 90% of people give dreams enough credence, Rob. You know, I used to do a lot of dream work for many years, going to sleep, programming myself to look for an answer whenever I went to sleep, things like that. It wasn't until I started remote viewing that I started looking at dreams, and I'd always considered dreams as some kind of premonition, what have you. But it wasn't until I started remote viewing that I really fully started understanding that connection to subconscious and how that connection to subconscious is a larger connection to numerous worlds and realities that we step in and out of all the time. We autonomically go through most of our day. We are in a state of rote hypnosis. You may think I'm thirsty, but you don't think, let me get up, legs, move, take me to the refrigerator. All of that happens autonomically. We don't process those things. We don't emotionally feel about those things. If we do, we're probably repressing it, so that we can keep driving down the road to work, things like that. And it's not until we sleep and rest that our brain gets to actively, not just like karate reflex react to the world around us, but actively process those things that we just kind of shove to the side all day long and just shove into a bag as they happen to us. And that connection to that, to our reality and to other realms, is absolutely fascinating to me. So the fact that you had dreams about your dog, before this happened is awesome. Awesome. Beautifully moving, man. So before we let you go, what message would you have for anybody out there that is looking to connect with their past animal, with their past fur baby? I should actually just say relocated fur baby. It's not past. They're still in the present, still in what we know as the present and consider the present, you know, because they're ever present. They're always around us. They're always with us. So what advice would you give to somebody who is out there looking for that connection?
Trust your feelings. Look around. Be very aware around birthdays, anniversaries, and holidays. I mean, so many different they can do the same thing humans do. They brought cleanse, look at the hair of them, especially around Christmas time. If you find an ornament on the floor and you had a dog, still have to knock them off. That's probably a sign from your dog. Ask them to come into your dreams. Look at the picture before you go to bed. Ask them if your grief is not too, they can come into your dreams, within reasonable level. But know that they can hear you, they can see you, and they're all about love. They can find you anywhere. And there's nothing to forgive. Cross over. That takes a lot of courage, and that is the greatest act of it.
Yeah, absolutely. Rob, thank you so much for your time tonight. Thank you so much. It's always great talking with you. I can always tell a good show because my fingertips tingle after. and they always do with you, man, because you have such a beautiful message behind your work. I love everything about it. Before we let you go, let everybody know where they can go to get their copy of Haunting of Emery Estate, as well as your new book, Ghost of Linville Manor.
They can go on Amazon, get them, paperback book and audiobook, and go to rodvetro.com, or you can go to petspirits.com, and there's a link to that all there, too.
Fantastic.
And we'll have this video out there, too. So thank you.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for your time tonight. Thank you for your beautiful open heart and mind and all that you do, Rob. Many blessings to you and your family during this time of heavenly celebration from the loss of your friend. I'll be in touch with links, all of that kind of good stuff. Take care, my friend.
Thank you.
Have a great evening.
Good night.
All right. Man, always such an awesome conversation with Rob, and always so uplifting. Even though you're talking about animals and family that have passed. And it's always fascinating to me the fact that he has bypassed the world of people spirit reading and gone to animals, because we like to carry that baggage with us, folks, and that baggage goes with us even after we're gone, you know. So good on him for realizing that with himself, with his heart, and with his work. So thank you so much, Rob, for your time tonight. Once again, everybody, make sure to stop on by robgutro.com. That is where you can find links to all of his books. That's where you can find his blog. That's where you can find upcoming events. That is where you can also contact Rob to get a pet reading. While you're online, of course, make sure to stop on by Curious Realm. That's where you can like, follow, subscribe. That's where you can find your link to Curious Research and our field observation and encounter log, as well as amazing music for therapeutic use, binaural beats, all that kind of good stuff. And don't forget, folks, before we go out to commercial, coming up December 10th in San Antonio, we will have the Symposium of the Strange. This month, we will have Sasquatch Structures in Texas with our good friend Rod Nichols, Bayer County Bigfoot. So, if you're in Texas, everybody, especially in the San Antonio area, stop on by, check that out. We can't wait to see you there. Stay tuned through this quick break, everybody. When we come back, we will be joined by our good friends, Chester Moore and Paul Fazinski. We will be talking about their new documentary about lost tribes and feral people living in the far east woods of Texas. We will get into that and so much more right after this.
The key to good science is good research. At the heart of good research is a good data set. With the field observation and encounter log from Curious Research, you can easily keep track of your investigative information all in one place, making it easier to review cases and readily see comparisons and contrasts between them. Whether out in the woods squatching, in a back room gathering EVPs, or using high-tech gear to track UFO UAP activity, this easy-to-carry, pocket-sized scientific data log is the perfect companion for any field researcher. You can find your copy of the Curious Research Field Observation and Encounter Log at Amazon.com, or visit the official Curious Realm store at CuriousRealm.com/store. to reserve your copy for yourself, your family, or a mind that you want to open. That website again is CuriousRealm.com/store.
Well, hello, everybody, and welcome back from that quick break. Thank you so much for staying tuned through that. Also, thank you so much to our sponsors, especially True Hemp Science. If you're a user of CBD products like I am, stop on by TrueHempScience.com today. They are your source for amazing, holistically made CBD products. No chemicals involved in the process, nothing like that. Christopher Lynch and True Hemp Science actually use a spigeric process where every part of the plant is used. Hemp seeds, buds, stems, roots, leaves, all of it is used, reused, combusted, and reused over and over again until nothing remains except for an amazing spigerically made product full of terpenes and other amazing compounds that do your body good. Stop on by, check them out. I have used True Hemp Science for the last 5 years of my life. They are great. They work amazing for my hands, things like that. Stop on by. TrueHempScience.com is the website that you want to go to. Curious7 is the code that you want to use to save 7% off your entire cart of $50 or more and get two free edibles as well. Our guests in this segment, I am so excited for this, our good friend Chester Moore and his filmmaking cohort, Paul Fazinski, are back. And if you remember, probably about a month or so ago, we had Lyle Blackburn on talking about feral humans, specifically lost tribes here in Texas. And the documentary that he mentioned that he was making with Chester Moore has been released, and it is out right now on YouTube, folks. It is great.
Jump off the here's well, a little bit of that page in that case. So that kind of led me further down to think, okay, maybe there's more to this.
A woman from Saratoga told Rob Riggs that some male members of her family had gone hunting somewhere along the Little Pine Island Bayou. They had just come around a bend in the stream when they were stunned to see a, quote, large, almost naked Indian in a rough-hewn dugout boat.
And this is what fascinates me, is the idea that there may be remnant societies still out in the wilds of Texas and beyond. Guys, welcome back to the show. How have y'all been doing?
We're doing good, man. You know, it's been a wild ride, all of us putting this together. And, you know, the actual expedition part of that was back in March.
Yeah.
But there's been a lot going on, and there's some new developments, and it's just excited to have it out and getting a lot of good response from the public.
I am very glad to hear about the response, because it is one of those, especially here in Texas. You know, we, as you know, you just came back from Texas Bigfoot and things like that, Texas Bigfoot Conference. We have all kinds of Bigfoot sightings in Texas, things like that. But the idea of a lost tribe of feral humans living in the woods of Texas is pretty wild. How did you first come across this story, Chester?
The same way that Lyle Blackburn came across, we both read the same book many years ago, and that is On the Trail of the Wild Man by Rob Riggs, who was a friend of mine. And I actually had spoken to Riggs about these sightings a long 20 years ago. And I kind of forgot about them. Mm. And then Lyle mentioned them to me about a year and a half ago because of something he came across. And I went back and opened the book, and it really opened my eyes to some things that I thought might be happening out there. I started investigating what's kind of loosely called the feral human phenomenon.
Sure.
And to me, it made more sense that if there are people living in a primitive way that's even more primitive than we might think is possible, you know, it's not some ginger kid from the farm that got thrown out and started a civilization. Maybe it's people who always lived wild, but somehow someone tapped into how to go even into more of a primitive state and remain hidden. And that's really how, as Lyle told me recently, he's like, yeah, Chester, he was explaining to someone. Yeah, Chester, I mentioned it to him, and like 2 days later, he calls me, we're making a documentary. And of course, that's where Paul comes in, because Paul is an incredible videographer, filmmaker, and he runs the Wild Man of the Woods Bigfoot YouTube channel. Oh. And does a lot of great work. And I'm like, you want a crazy expedition? And of course, Paul said yes.
Now, have you ever done a documentary like this before, Paul? I know you do quite a bit in the world of wildlife documentaries, stuff like that, conservation documentary, same as what Chester does with photography and his writing. But have you ever made a documentary about a topic like this before?
I've made a couple of Bigfoot documentaries, okay, as Chester said, with the Wild Man of the Woods stuff, but those are just kind of like interview driven, you know, hearing people's encounters and cool stuff like that. But then when it came to this feral human stuff, it's like quasi in that world of the quasi paranormal, but it's not because it's humans. Yeah. You know what I mean? Like, there's no, within this topic, there's no, this could be some supernatural thing. It's just like, these could be people living out in the woods. And, frankly, that's a little more scary because, you know, as in true Chester fashion, you know, every time I'm with him, he's like dragging me into dangerous stuff. There's grizzly bears, there's great white sharks, there's, and you get into the feral human topic and they're like, oh yeah, all these reports are awesome. You should check them out. So I read the book and every report's like, yeah, they shot arrows at everyone and they tried to kill him. And I'm like, let's go look for it, I guess. That's just every time I go with Chester, it's always about putting your life on the line, I guess, for some creepy stuff. So I had a blast doing this and I really enjoyed it. It was definitely a trip into a different topic, and I had a lot more room to play with the, you know, the theme of the documentary. I could use a lot more of that, like, Native American style music and a lot more of that, like, down to earth, creepy Texas swamps. I didn't have to exaggerate anything.
Sure.
And do any crazy reenactment stuff because it was all stuff like we were in the swamps and it was dark and creepy like that. It didn't do anything to make them look like that. That's just what they look like. And yeah, it was an awesome experience. And, you know, I think we're going to do it again.
You know, because we have another part of this we want to look into, which is, you know, Appalachia and the classic feral human stuff. We're already working an event in Tennessee with a friend, Randy Hutchings, and so we're gonna slide over and do something with that. But even in Texas, since the documentary's come out, some things I can't talk about yet, but just to say this, there's more reports.
Fascinating. And once again, the idea of this, you regularly on Dark Outdoors, Chester, the motto is pack heat, you know, the most dangerous thing out in the woods isn't the bear or anything like that or a hog. It's other people. So yeah, especially if you're looking at something along those lines, something, the fact of there is a tribe of people that are out there hunting, doing whatever they do. Like you were saying, Paul,
it's a little dangerous thing in the Morehouse. So does my hungry bull mastiff. So I apologize
You're good
for the insanity of that, but that is it's a great point, Chris. And it wasn't one of those things where I was scared to go do or anything, because we really had to establish whether this was even feasible, like the concept of it, or these were just old stories. I definitely believe for sure that there were things going on out there related to some kind of primitive living people, at least up until the 80s, early 90s. I have reasons to believe now that it extended far beyond that and possibly today. And like I said, you have these stories of feral humans, right? You have these feral human stories. And, you know, it's somebody gets kidnapped and they find some weird looking hillbillies in the woods. And, you know, there's this culture of people. And I think there probably is definitely something. Matter of fact, shameless capitalism plug, I have a new book out and you're the first one to get a look at it. Feral Humans, $15, including shipping. You can go to darkoutdoors.com and get that book. And I talk about that aspect of all of that. But I think it makes more sense if there are people that are living off grid. For example, if there's lost tribes, if there are small remnants left, their bodies would even physiologically be more apt to be able to take all of the infections and weather and things, and someone just thrown out into that. So that was just a really interesting and part of the concept for me. And it's funny because on the Bigfoot end of stuff, people are fascinated, but people are scared to death of this feral human stuff.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's just it. There's a difference there. And that's what I was going to say is that, like you were saying, Paul, you get to look at it as a different way, even as a filmmaker. But even the idea of, once again, the most dangerous thing being out there isn't Bigfoot or something like that. It's other people. So even, you know, no different than walking across some rancher's property line without realizing it in Texas. Yeah, like that's how you get greeted with shotguns at dusk and dawn, you know, that kind of stuff. Much less if you're roaming into somebody's hunting territory or something like that, or coming near their camp. And yeah, like when we had Lyle on, I, like, you know, Chester, I come from a Cajun heritage. I have a few family members that could probably just skiff up the bayou and you'd be lucky if you ever saw them again. They'd be able to live just fine. They'd be able to trap. They'd be able to hunt. They'd be able to trot line and fish. And you'd be lucky if you ever saw them or their kin that come after ever again. And
well, one of the things on that same point of like even people that we know of and that have the ability to live in modern world and the faculty to do it. I think the thing you have to look at is what like a feral human is, like the definition of that. It's not really
that real quick.
A definition. And a feral can mean two things. It can mean formally domesticated and going back into the wild, or it could just mean wild. And in this case, I think we're looking at both. It's certainly not a knock on any primitive people in the native world that would still be surviving. As a matter of fact, we talk about this in a documentary. Lyle and I and Paul as well gained a tremendous amount of respect for the idea that someone, a civilization, could stay possibly still hidden out there in kinds of land. So it's not like calling something a feral human is a knock. It's just the terminology that's been used out there. And it's really interesting. In the book, I didn't get this into the documentary because I really, the documentary inspired me to go dig deeper and put something out on it. One of the one of my thoughts was fire creation. Like, that's typically a limiting factor in peoples. But there have actually, on Earth right now, there are a couple of civilizations that they don't think use fire. And there have been people that have made it without using fire. And even in what we, like in Maine, there was a guy.
Yep.
Made it years. So just some of those limiting factors, I think we had to kind of get over. And Paul, wouldn't you say that this was like kind of like an exploratory mission, really, to like see what did we think about this? Like no one had ever, literally, no one in the world has ever went out and looked for this except us. And we wanted to go out and just see what we thought of the potential to be out there. And to me, that was a really exciting part of it.
Yeah, and it's a different world when you're wandering out in the woods, because like with wildlife, they're fairly predictable. I mean, there's two outcomes. They're either going to attack you or they're going to run away. And most of the time they're going to run away. I mean, that's what wildlife do. They don't want to be near you. But with people, you don't know what they're going to do. They could act like they're your buddy and then come up and try and rob you or something. And when you're in the middle of the woods and you don't have, you know, any safety ties out there, that's the creepy part. So, I mean, and it's really fun to go out and investigate like this at, you know, you watch the TV shows and everybody goes out with nights and thermal cameras and night vision stuff. And it's cool to watch on TV, but when you're the one there doing it, it's a much different story than seeing it on TV. Cause, weird stuff happens out in the woods and, you know, most of the time it's probably just animals or whatever, but gets your heart racing. You can't see. We're a species that relies heavily on our sight for, you know, how we interact with that world.
Yeah.
And not being able to see out there in the dark, even with a thermal or something, it's very disorienting and it's very creepy. And it's kind of a fun thrill, if you will, for us people who are into this kind of stuff.
Yeah. Yeah, most definitely. And once again, gets you out into the, because you guys are both used to tracking, videotaping, photographing wildlife, all kinds of things, you know. But when you're hunting the wiliest of game, man, things get a little different, you know. Yeah. You can be a little more on point because, as opposed to an animal, like you were saying, Paul, that you can get very used to its habits. You can figure out how to circumvent it. You can figure out how to go around it without it realizing, all kinds of things. Trying to do that for a person is totally different.
Mm-hmm. I mean, humans are really you know, tuned into stuff too, because, you know, we're constantly surrounded. You know, I get freaked out when I can't find my earpods or whatever, and I can't listen to my audiobook or whatever I'm doing. And, but when you're outside and you spend, you know, even a couple of days in the outdoors without electronics or something, it's a different plane. And if that's all you know, it would be pretty, I think it'd be pretty easy to hide, because like, even, you know, like we have wireless chargers for our cell phones now and things like that. Yeah. And if you listen close, you can hear these hums and these crackles and these buzzes and all this technology. When you're out in the woods, I would imagine you'd be able to hear stuff like trail cams clicking and humming and buzzing with their battery power and stuff, and the signal they're putting off to the Wi-Fi up into satellites with their SIM cards and all this stuff. Like, I don't think it's that big of a stretch, because animals can hear it.
Yeah.
And if, you know, you're not like one of us who's got tinnitus from listening to, you know, AC/DC at full volume for 30 years, you know, you could probably hear a lot better. And, you know, I don't think it's out of the realm of possibility for there to be people still living out there. Now, do I think it's common? No, there might be a couple. There might be a very, very small few, but, you know, sometimes I think we all have that, idea that, you know, paying taxes isn't the most awesome thing in the world. Right. We'd like to go out and hide in the woods too for a while, but make it illegal.
Well, what made it most interesting to me in that realm was what brought it up to modernity was when I first started the dark outdoors, the concept of dark outdoors was around 4 years ago. And I reached out to a friend of mine who was in law enforcement in a very rural area. And I said, hey, man, you got to have some crazy running into meth head stories or something. And he told me two stories. One, I cannot tell because it's just too dangerous for me to tell. It's one of those, oh, you shouldn't have told me that deals.
You know,
I'm not going to talk on the air about that one. And the other one was about a wild man. Now, when he said wild man, I thought Bigfoot.
Sure.
And I'm like, ah, another Bigfoot story, whatever. But then he started telling me the story, and it was interesting, but I didn't have anything to do to use it for at the time. But when Lyle brought this up to me, and I looked into Rob, looking at Rob Riggs' book, went, oh, that story, because it was in the exact area that most of the reports came from. And that really took it to a new level for us, because it brings it up to 2020. Now, the report that he had was not necessarily a native, primitive-looking native person. They didn't get that close of a look. But as you'll see in the documentary, we have him blacked out. By the way, he said, I'll speak with, you know, fully on camera.
Yeah.
He's no longer in law enforcement. He got a much cushier gig now. But I was like, no, we're going to protect the identity. So that's probably a good idea, you know, but it was a legitimate thing. And, you know, Paul recorded it and masked it out. And that was interesting to me, because what he described, as we talk about in the documentary, that, that whole thing to me was, I don't know if Paul, if we'd have really had a compelling documentary without that.
Yeah, that was weird, because I mean, you told me we were going to interview someone about this, but I was just kind of like, you know, I hadn't read the Rob Riggs book yet, and you and Lyle had just been like talking about like this feral human thing. And for me, I'm just like, whatever, I'm going to go here and film this documentary, another wild ride with Chester.
Right.
But then he came into the place we recorded, and I'm just like hearing this in real time. I'm like, what the heck, dude? Like, this is crazy. And this is like, you know, a pretty like stand-up guy, you know, he's a very intelligent dude. It's not just some random guy that we pulled in off the street. He's someone Chester knows, and you know, I've met him, and you know, it was just wild to hear that story in person. And then, you know, to do the recreations and all that stuff was fun too. People looked at us like we were crazy walking around in cop costumes out in the in a park doing that recreations, but I think that's kind of what brought that stuff to life too. And you know, the wild man recreations in there were a lot of fun. So yeah, this was just a cool documentary. It kind of pushed me to try weird stuff that I would normally would not do. Yeah, it's just out there. It's cool.
Yeah. And on the part of his story, I just want to reiterate that I wasn't on the feral human trajectory or the primitive tribe trajectory even remotely when I got this. So I didn't do anything with it, but it clicked with me after, you know, we started talking about this. So it wasn't like he goes, oh, I got a primitive story to contribute, but it was in the exact location, like exact. And that's what really blew our minds. And Paul mentioned, all the recreations. My buddy Levi did. He's the menacing guy in the bushes on this one, and he's like 6'5", and he did a really good job. All that, and Paul makes it look so horror movie-esque and cool. And to me, those scenes look like an old In Search of a Leonard Nimoy, which is a high compliment.
Well, and you know, when we had Lyle on talking about this before its release, we got into some of the stories of feral people that have been found, like just in our lifetimes. The Romanian child, all kinds of things. There have been numerous quote feral people who have been found over the years. But it's a little different when you're talking about this, when you're talking about a possible tribe of people that has purposefully not integrated, as Lyle says in the documentary, didn't really go down the route to the Trail of Tears, things like that, and end up on a reservation.
And one of the comments I got from someone watching the video, and I'm not going to try to pronounce their people group because I am a regular just guy from Southeast Texas who can't pronounce his own name half the time. But they are a native people, and they told me that in their traditions that there were people that broke off the Trail of Tears, rogues sort of, and kind of went underground. You know, they are traditions of that. So that, and I'm not a native culture expert here, but what I am an expert on is wild places and wild ground. And that really was part of all of this. I mean, everything that Paul does with his documentaries, if you look close enough, you're going to see a message of like, let's keep wild places wild. Let's do this. And this really took the concept of development and progress, so to speak, to a new playing field here in the United States. Now, we can't prove anything, you know, we're not out there, you know, trying to get contact if they're still out there. We were looking. But if you think about this, it's one thing to say that there is a species that might go extinct. Another thing to think about that you're encircling maybe the last part of a primitive people. And in our area, it's interesting because the area that we were in was mainly around the Old and Lost River. And along Trinity Bay, Trinity River area.
And it was
the Atakapa and the Karankawa were, it's kind of where their ranges met up.
Yeah.
It was like the extreme eastern side of one and western of the other. And they have cannibal traditions in both. And it's just kind of a mysterious group of people because both just disappeared, you know.
Yeah.
And I know there are people that I've seen since we did the documentary now that say they have that lineage somehow and on both sides. And maybe they do. I don't know. I haven't really investigated that. But ours wasn't about – this documentary is not about whether it's a native culture. I mentioned, could it be some kind of strange survivalist group or people wanted to go back into nature? What it is about is, could our wild lands in America – house humanity that have completely cracked the code of the system? Really, that in my mind, that's what it's about.
Exactly. And one of the things that we got into with Lyle for a little while that I've been fascinated with since it came out a few years ago was the Wolfman that was spotted in the Harz Mountains of Germany. This guy who very much looks Neanderthal, almost caveman-esque with his large staff. But this was an actual picture taken on a riverbank in the Harz Mountains of Germany. And yeah, it brings about the question, you know, like we say so many times, Chester, when it comes to Bigfoot or any animal, does it have the area to range? Does it have available water supply that it needs for its body size and the type of animal it is? And does it have food that it can either graze on or chase and eat? you know, if it's herbivorous or omnivorous or what have you. So as long as those things exist, then shelter can be made. Fire can be made, you know? So, yeah, I mean, to me, it's not rocket math to think that there may be small pockets all over the country, all over numerous countries.
Well, what was interesting, I'm going to take this off the wall here. This is the original artwork. You'll see this artwork in the documentary there. And this is my incredible artist friend, Calvin Carter, did the artwork. And this is one of the stories from Rob Riggs' book. And it's the one that made me think there was something to it.
Yeah.
It's a lineman who had these native men come out and scowl at him and look at him as he's up the pole down in that Old and Lost River area. And as a writer, there are certain things that I look at as far as if I'm going to try to make up a legend or a story, you know, like I wouldn't put a lineman seeing him come out. It would be a much more wild story. You know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
And to me, that just sounded like old Bigfoot reports before people got into knowing about everything that we supposedly think we know about Bigfoot. People talk about limb breaks and limb twists and whoops and all this stuff. Used to be people would say, "Hey, I saw a big, tall, hairy thing cross the road on two legs."
Yeah.
So to me, that was that kind of report. We were just, this is what happened. And to me, that's the one that really made me think the book had some credence to it in terms of what Rob Riggs had collected, because he had collected numerous of those reports. And it was cool, man. And, you know, Paul, what was interesting for me, I don't know if you even told Paul this, but watching Paul film on this one was really interesting because, you know, he is so in the field, like looking at the lid, looking exactly to make sure everything is so framed beautifully and or creepily. And we're going into some weird territory here. And, you know, and I kind of got to think sometimes that the cinematographer, the person actually doing the filming, has to almost have a little bit of a different perspective of what you're looking at, because you don't see the whole scene. You're kind of really immersed in it in that moment.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it's a lot to, with Chester and Lyle, we're full steam ahead, baby. We just go. So it's a lot to do, but it's fun. And yeah, it's, you're kind of just looking through the lens on the camera the whole time, because you're trying to focus on the technical aspects, like am I capturing their audio, am I you know, making sure that this is lit properly, am I making sure that this is exposed properly, you know, is the gimbal set up right, because we're on boats and we're going in crazy places, is my bag, you know, do I have all the right equipment? So you're constantly like worrying about all that. But then, you know, for me, where the stuff really happens, where the story kind of feels alive, is when you're in these interviews, like you're interviewing Chester, you're interviewing Lyle, you're interviewing, you know, the guy with his face blacked out, and you're talking to, you know, people behind the scenes, and you're hearing these stories for the first time after you're so focused on the technical details, and you're like, what are we doing? You know, there's like a wild, crazy story here. And then, you know, because I'm always thinking, as the guy filming it, I'm like, my biggest concern is making sure we have enough footage to tell the story. So, you know, Chester and Lyle are running around like hooligans out there in the woods at full speed. I'm trying to keep up and swap lenses. And then, you know, you stop for a second and you're like, I don't know where I'm at. I haven't been paying attention to where we've been walking. I haven't been paying attention to which direction we've been going. And I'm just like fully like, I hope these guys know how to get out of here. This is going to be a real Cannibal Indian story, because I'm going to start getting hungry here in a few hours.
Yeah,
so,
right.
But it is very cool to do these projects and just to go to these places. Like, just being in the Big Thicket is cool. It's such a historically awesome place. It's such a, you know, mythologically wild place with all these, like, you know, historical accounts of anything from the ghost lights and the Bigfoot encounters and the feral humans and alligators and poisonous snakes or venomous snakes. And it's just a weird place, man. You Texans are a different breed. We don't have any of that up here where I live.
Well, and you know, that that brings up a point, especially the fact of getting out into that. I just had up a small clip of some of the area there. And that's what I think a lot of people don't understand whenever you're talking about the big thicket area, that kind of stuff, is that you could be talking thicket that's so thick that, hey, you can't see 8 to 10 feet in front of you. Number one. Number two, that could go on for miles and miles.
And what
miles.
We're talking about here is not the preserve.
Yeah.
This is the region of the Big Thicket. This isn't, you know, Big Thicket National Preserve. This is the region. And so it kind of goes from north of the preserve all the way down to the coast almost, you know, that whole area. And most of our time was actually spent in that Old and Lost River segment. But it was interesting because it went from like hardwood forest that you couldn't see 5 feet in to within a few hundred yards, you're into coastal marsh that had its own thickness to it. And in that coastal marsh part is where we actually found something quite interesting that's on the documentary. And so please go watch it on the Chestermore Wildlife Journalist Investigator YouTube channel. And Paul has a Wildman Mysteries that should be out by the time people see this. It's going to have some of this as well as the Saratoga Ghost Light stuff on there as well.
Well,
yeah, go ahead.
No, please go ahead.
So when filming the documentary that Chester put out, the main focus, the whole focus was on these feral human lost tribe kind of storyline. But I mean, as anyone who makes stuff like this knows, there was tons and tons and tons of footage. I mean, for every interview section you're seeing in this documentary, there's another hour and a half of interview you're not seeing. So I just kind of picked up on some of the weirder stuff for the Wild Man of the Woods channel to just kind of like make a companion documentary to this documentary. And there's a whole section we didn't use where we drove down the Bragg Road where the Saratoga Ghost Lights are.
Oh, wow.
Chester and Lyle talked about that a little bit. And that's just a cool mystery in and of itself, because there's tons of those ghost lights out there. And, you know, if you follow any of the Bigfoot stuff, it's constantly they talk about, you know, people who see Bigfoot often will see these glowing lights in the woods as like this strange quasi phenomenon happening around them. And then also on top of it, you know, literally the word wild man in the sense of it often gets thrown around in the Bigfoot stuff. So on the Wild Man of the Woods channel, it's just a amalgamation of these three topics, and like it's very weird that they all exist in the same little stretch of it. Well, there's nothing little about the Big Thicket, but this stretch of area that's just such a creepy place to begin with. So I kind of took that direction on my channel, and Chester pretty much wrote that one. That was he helped me kind of to stick it all together, because I literally wrapped the final edit for the documentary that Chester put out, and they were premiering it like within a day or two at the Bigfoot conference. We got the final edits, everything. Lyle got his word in on it, and everything was done. And then I was like, because I'm insane, I guess, I was like, I want to put something out by this Halloween, which gave me about a week and a half to make a documentary, because I had to leave out of town and do some work, and I didn't have a lot of time. So I was like, Chester, can you give me a hand here? And he kind of wrote out a script that made sense with what we had. And
nice.
I think it turned out pretty cool. It's just a weird mysteries. I'm a huge fan of Unsolved Mysteries. So I named a little series I do for the off the beaten path stuff that's not necessarily Bigfoot related, like the theme of the channel. And yeah, it'll be interesting. I'm interested to see how people react to it, because I've never done anything like that before, especially in the more paranormal realm with the ghost light stuff. I've never really touched those topics, and it's just fun.
Yeah.
I like to keep people entertained. It's a fun thing to do for people, you know?
Yeah. And that, once again, that whole area is rife with paranormal stories, things like that. So to hear that, and once again, these stories that came through not only to Riggs, but that have come through to you since this release and just before Chester, come by, they, It's not like drunk fishermen or something like that. Like, they are normal, upstanding people, people that work in law enforcement, stuff like that.
I had another law enforcement officer in a different county reach out, and I'm hope maybe meeting with him next week. So
fascinating.
He may be linking me with another law enforcement officer who has his own accounts, and this guy has some secondhand accounts from someone he's talked to about
from
a piece
the same
of property
area?
I've been on before. When I've been on this property, I hunted it 20 years ago, but it's like a gigantic chunk of private property.
Okay.
And I never heard of anything like that out there before, but apparently someone had. So that just kind of, I got to go vet all this stuff.
Yeah.
But it just shows that you don't know what's all out there, and that there are mysteries. And that's the fun part of this. And I say this in all the talks I do at these sort of cryptid conferences that, you know, I believe in being positive. I believe in let's create more community and just have fun and not fight over our little positions on stuff.
Yeah.
And at the end of the day, all of us involved in this are playing Scooby-Doo. We're rolling up our camo mystery machine, or maybe our one with a Bigfoot sticker on the back.
Yeah.
And looking for monsters. And at the end of Scooby-Doo, they would go up and there'd be the guy in the gorilla costume or the sea monster costume, and they pull
the mask. Yeah, old man Withers.
Yeah, well, what's going to happen one day with this kind of stuff? Somebody's going to go pull the mask off, and it's not going to be a mask. And that's kind of the way I look at all this stuff. So that's my way to keep me focused on that this is a fun, interesting thing. And then me and Paul are always working together to make sure there is a pro-wild lands, wild places, wildlife message and all these things.
You know, that is one of the things that, again, even whenever we have King Gerhard on, whenever we have Lyle on, what have you talking about cryptids, cryptozoology, that kind of stuff. One of the things that we bring up regularly is if you are into Bigfoot, hey, if you're into the Jersey Devil, I don't care. If you're into these cryptids, what you need to do is get into where they live. You need to get into the conservation of the actual land that they live on or that sightings tend to happen. Things like that, because if you don't conserve it, the only thing that's going to happen is that they'll be rooting through the trash cans in the apartment complex that goes up next to it, you know? Yeah. And we see that with regular wildlife all the time. So, yeah, the importance of conservation and getting this kind of stuff protected, getting these kinds of lands protected, is hugely important, especially there in that Old River, Lost River Basin. It really is a unique ecosystem amongst all that.
I tell people, find a species or a group of animals you like. Find a habitat that you care about. And go join an organization that advocates for it. I like to support the hunting and fishing based organizations because they're a lot more rooted in reality on money, making it work in conservation. So groups like Ducks Unlimited and Delta Waterfowl down on the coast and the marshes. When you go into, you know, upland, maybe you're someone who supports, you know, you can join like the National Deer Alliance or whatever you're into. There is out west, the Rocky Mountain Elk Foundation or the Wild Sheep Foundation. And if you're a fisherman, CCA, if you know, all these groups that are spending millions of dollars advocating for these wild places make a difference. And Paul and I work in that world. I work in it full time. Paul is starting to work in it quite a bit. And it's amazing how much actually is done to keep all of the wild places wild and the wildlife out there. And that's all. That's why, like, I've started my Gulf Great White Shark Society.
Yep.
And all of those things like that, like we did with the Great White documentaries, is to just take the idea of making people inspired about conservation to a new level. And I'm always grateful, Chris, that you allow when I come on for me to ramble on about conservation at some point, because you know it's going to come out of my mouth. I appreciate that.
Well, it's something that's hugely important. We both have kids that are right up around the same age, you and I, Chester, and it really is one of the – I was brought up hunting by my grandfather, my son's namesake, fishing, things like that. And I don't get to go out and do it nearly as much as I should with my son. But it is one of those – when you do that and you do that regularly, you have a different appreciation for the world around you to begin with.
Yeah.
And it really is the concept of not just paying it forward, but making sure it's still there.
Yeah.
Because
that's a great way to look at that.
It disappears so fast, so fast. Uh-huh.
I have 1,800 acres. I can look out this window right here in my house. And the first time I ever saw a mountain lion, I was rabbit hunting. I didn't know it was illegal to hunt the railroad tracks. Nobody tell the game warden. Okay. I was 14 years old with my
pelt. Dude.
Yeah. It's statute of limitations ran out. And I had my pellet gun and I, you know, we were only allowed to kill what we ate. And I would go in the evening sometimes at the school and go hunt rabbits along the rice field by the railroad tracks out here. And I ran into a mountain lion out there. It was a transformative encounter.
Yeah.
And that piece of land now in one fell swoop went from 1,800 acres of some of the last wild habitat, the little part of the part of the county that I live in. And a refinery bought it, and within 6 months, there wasn't a tree left on it. And it now is an industrial wasteland. And so I'm grateful people have jobs, but I'm also a wildlife guy. And so that's happening all around America right now.
Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, I'm sure you can speak to that as well, Paul, with the conservation work you do, all that kind of stuff.
Yeah. I mean, it is just... You know, there's so much wild land getting eaten up every day. I don't remember the number, but it's something insane. Like, I don't know. Maybe you can correct me, Chester. It's like an acre every second or something. Just insane. Wow. Just getting eaten up. And, you know, it doesn't matter what you're into. If you're like me and you're super into like the super awesome wildlife around where I live and out west and all of these just epic creatures that we all take for granted, or if you're into Bigfoot or you're into, like you said, the Jersey Devil, there ain't no place for them to live. They're not going to be around for you to go chase anywhere. So you might as well like start, if that's your hobby and if that's what you love to do is go rock around in the woods with thermal cameras and track down Bigfoot. If there's nowhere for you to do that, well, guess what?
Yeah.
Not a possibility for you. Yeah, so it's got to be important to everyone.
Sorry for the bull mastiff craziness tonight.
You never have to apologize for a fur baby.
Yeah, well, this exactly is a 130-pound fur baby that's disturbed about something.
Might be Bigfoot.
Yeah, right?
I think it's the new neighbors behind us with the Belgian Malinois that doesn't shut up. So he's like, they got a new one in the hood, man. I'm going to have to go show him what's up.
Yeah, right. Well, and, you know, the idea, once again, of feral humans being out in the woods, being I'm very fascinated to see what y'all come up with from Tennessee.
Yeah, me too.
That's going to be really interesting because, yeah, there are tons of stories from the Appalachians, even whenever you're talking about like Cherokee little people, stuff like that. From that area.
We went backwards. We went to the thing no one's hardly ever heard of, and then we're going to go to the one that's kind of the mainstay of the feral human talk. And I think going here first will help us because it's making us look at it differently. Like I believe with almost 100% that there were some kind of primitive natives still living in that old Lost River region until at least the 80s or so when there were reports. I really believe that was a thing. It's possible now. But that kind of invading people is going to look a little different than what's been talked about in some of those areas of Smokies. So we're going to look at both sides of it. Could there still be maybe tribal type, and then could there be these other kinds? And honestly, the tribal type, not nearly as spooky, other than I think if you walked up and saw a dude look a Karankawa from the 1800s.
Yeah.
I mean, it would scare the mess out of you because you think you slipped through some portal, right? You'd be like, oh my God, I'm out of place. What happened? But if you run into some of these like hillbilly like stories of people running into feral people in the Appalachians, it goes back to the Dark Outdoors motto, pray, prepare, and pack heat, because you don't know, you know? And also on that, I'm sort of curious how many people might have just in the last 10 to 15 years decided to go check out and live wild, if that's a thing too. So we don't know. And so it's a true investigation. Wouldn't you say it's more of a most of our documentaries have been telling accounts of.
Yeah.
Is more, I would say, Paul, more of an ongoing investigation type.
Yeah. And, you know, I'm excited to go do this stuff in the Smokies area, Tennessee and all that. I actually, when I was graduated college, I did a through hike of the Appalachian Trail. And there are definitely people living out there. There is no doubt about that. I would not put them on the feral human kind of plane because that's kind of more they've always lived out there or. But there are I mean, there are stories of in the news of in the last 10 years of people who were on the run from the law, and they were out there for years before they got caught because, you know, there's just it's such a surrounded by so much city and so much, you know, big city like New York. All these major East Coast cities are along the Appalachian Trail. But I mean, it 2 miles off the road, nobody's going out there regularly looking and it's hikers. And there were definitely moments where I ran into people who were shady and you could tell that they were not, you know, your regular backpacker out there enjoying the wilderness for a weekend. They were holed up. They were, you know, intimidating. They were weird. You know, they were talking about like carrying guns and, you know, I've been out here for 2 months and it's just like, there's definitely people out there that are on the verge of being, I guess, feral. I've experienced them myself. I mean, there's guys, you know, a backpacker out there, they have a, you know, $300 backpack tent and they're wearing Patagonia and they're eating, you know, foil sealed meals and they have a $200 stove to boil their water. And then there's a guy out there that looks like he has a stolen kid's tent with a tarp draped over it. And he looks like he's wearing an old ripped Carhartt jacket that he hasn't seen a washing machine in a decade. And you're like, this is not the same kind of person in there. It's so, you know, I've personally run into these people. Mm-hmm. I wouldn't say that they were feral people, but this is definitely something that is happening out there. And this is, it's not a, out of a stretch. People can live, you know, you go run into town once and go hit a dollar store and you could buy enough food for 2 months to live out in the woods pretty frugally. And all you need is a couple of matches. It's definitely possible.
Well, and and if you're living somewhere where there is ample place to forage, ample place to fish, ample place to hunt, trap, things like that, once again, and that is something that I've brought up, especially when it can, and we need to get Rod Nichols back on. But that's one of the things that I've brought up numerous times in different communities about, like, Bigfoot nests, things like that, is there has been a large movement over the last decade of bushcraft is really the only way to put it. Like, I'm traveling, I'm going to build a shelter for the night, like a shelter, and then I'm going to strip that down as much as possible and move on, and I'm going to build another shelter and do the same thing, you know. So could it be that some of that is what's being found as remnant of that? And yeah, that culture has hugely taken off. Not only that, but just living off grid, that kind of stuff. So,
And to me, that ties into the there's two sides of dark outdoors.
Yeah, yeah.
There's safety and awareness. And then there's like the unsolved mysteries side. And to me, like the lost tribes part is the unsolved mysteries part.
Definitely.
But the people that I would say most of the people who want to go that far off grid have a reason. And a lot of it ain't good. And those are some of the people that I want. So that's kind of part in the back of our minds. Part of all this is like, what are we going to uncover? And what is going to really be out there? And on the Bigfoot side of this, this is kind of a Bigfoot adjacent topic. I'm looking at some of the evidence that I've seen and heard that's tied into Bigfoot a little differently now. Mm. And could some of that evidence not actually be a Bigfoot? Could it be some of this stuff?
Exactly. And,
so that to me is an interesting part, and it's been an exciting part, an honor to work with Paul and Lyle on this. And it's a lot of fun. I'm an investigator by nature. That's what I do. And this is one of the most interesting. I mean, my heart is wildlife, but this is really close to that. And it's a lot of fun, you know. And so there's always something interesting in it's, I think that's the thing. We all like those crazy campfire tales. And if you go, people listen to the Dark Outdoors podcast, you know, I may have one about Ted Bundy taking women into the woods and doing what he did, but the next one may be some weird encounter someone had. Like we have, like this week, the ghost lights on the, on Dark Outdoors. Kind of look at the scientific side of possible ghost lights on Dark Outdoors. Then we're going to have, you're seeing Lyle on here right now, Lyle talking about Momo and Lizard Man and the Lake Worth Monster for the Halloween edition. So
nice.
It's all about a different side of the outdoors, the dark side. And to me, that's tons of fun. But also, getting back to the heart of it, there's that safety and awareness side. And I'm always amazed, like with the Bigfoot phenomenon, people will argue with you that Bigfoots are the saviors of nature and that, you know, they would never hurt a person if they do exist. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, yeah.
And I'm like, well, there isn't a creature on the planet that doesn't hurt people from time to time. White-tailed deer kill people.
Sure.
So let's keep the safety part of what you're doing out here. I don't want someone getting the idea, hey, let's go out in the woods and find a feral human community. And the person who would probably do that would be from Austin. I hate to tell you this, Chris.
No, no, that's all right. I'm from Houston, buddy. Her. These people are crazy.
There's a type. It's Susie with the gluten-free sandwiches and the non-GMO stuff. And they moved to Beaumont.
She's trying to bring them the kale sandwiches.
They want to go commune with nature. They don't have a firearm. They don't know what's going on. Everybody's nice. And I told this story to our mutual buddy, Andrew Austin. And he goes, did you say Austin? I said, yeah. He goes, dude, a girl at work just did that. Moved out, took her family into a spot. He goes, and he knew where I'd found a meth lab years ago. And I quit going to this part of the woods. And he goes, she took him to where the meth lab thing you found was. I said, there they are. God. So, Susie, and all your friends, I love you. I respect that you love nature. But listen to a couple of episodes of Dark Outdoors because we don't want you running into the really feral people.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, and you know, I can't wait to see once again what you guys do with Tennessee. The documentary that y'all have put together for this was absolutely amazing. It was very well done. The two of you really do. Hey.
Face jumping in.
That's all right. The two of you really do make some amazing and beautiful content, guys. Y'all work really well together as a filmmaking team. And the documentary is just so well put together. And I can't wait to see what y'all come up with in Tennessee. It's going to be great.
Thank you.
Before
we're going to bring faith. We're going to bring faith for bait.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah.
Absolutely. But Chris, you know, I'm always so grateful that you allow me to come on and talk about my projects and talk about conservation and my ministry work and everything too. And I know that Lyle's grateful as well. And I just want to give a thanks again to Lyle and Paul for going on this crazy adventure. I mean, Lyle's kind of kicked it down the hill, you know, a little bit. And I just like went, we got to make a documentary.
Yeah.
So it was great because Lyle is such a great investigator and a presence and just a good friend. And, and it's always good to have his storytelling perspective. Cause I got chills listening to some of his narrations on the documentary. So, good stuff, man.
Yeah. And it was really cool when, Chester told me Lyle was in. I mean, I've seen Lyle in a ton of documentaries and TV shows. I've been watching all the Bigfoot stuff for as long as I can remember. And I was like, wow, this is going to be super fun. We're going to go two Texas guys out in the middle of the woods that know their stuff. It's fun. And you know, it's cool to see both of their different perspectives. Lyle has like a really awesome storytelling presence and he's just like really into the folklore of it all. And like, he just knows it inside and out. And then Chester, you know, really understands a lot of the folklore as well. There's a crossover there, but Chester like knows the wildlife and all the weird animals that the zoo of Texas has down there with all your weird exotic stuff. And, you know, I hear these animals. And I'm like, what the heck is that? And, you know, Chester can point it out and, you know, he makes you think about stuff that the average investigator is not going to think of. And, you know, even, you know, I was near Mount Hood last week out, and you know, that would be considered Bigfoot country. Yep. And, you know, hearing, you know, off in the distance, what most people would probably say are wood knocks, knowing that it's wild sheep in their rut smashing their heads together. I'm like, yeah, you know, yeah. and you don't think about that if you're not into wildlife. So there's so many cool things you learn doing this, and you learn what's not. Everything's not Bigfoot, everything's not a ghost, and everything's not a feral human. And it's really cool working with Lyle and Chester on this. And, you know, Chris, thanks for having us on again. I really appreciate the opportunity, and your show's always been really fun to come on. So
I appreciate it, man. And truly, like, anytime you guys have something to promote, feel free to reach out.
Can I tell one quick, after Halloween, I know, but one quick Halloween funny story?
Go ahead.
Okay, so Halloween time, right before we're recording this, and you know, there are people thinking about werewolves, and of course, everybody thinks everything in the woods is a dog man now, whatever that's supposed to be, right? And I had a guy tell me a story that he was investigating something in Texas out in the Edwards Plateau in this one particular area, and he saw something on the thermal, and it had big pointed, you know, like ears, you know, maybe doing like this and coming out and moving. And it's coming along, and it's about 5.5-6 feet tall. And he said, it's making this weird, like, it's just like weird bounding. And he sits there and he looks at it. And he said, all of a sudden, it just looks at him. And it has like a thin neck and bill, but it has this like wolfy looking head on the thermal. And then it just jumps in the air and bounds off. And he goes, do you think it was possibly a dog man of some kind? And then I went online and showed him a video of a red kangaroo. And that there are ranches in that area that have red kangaroos, and some of them get loose. And sometimes not everything's a cryptid. Sometimes it's something else kind of cool and funny. But the cool thing is, it only takes one report of one of these mysteries, whether it's a Bigfoot or a lost primitive person, to be real, for there to be a real phenomenon. And we're just trying to do our best to sort it all out.
No. And that's exactly it. Now, even to that point is something that I bring up regularly, Chester, which is, you know, even if you bring something to someone like you, who is an experienced tracker, Chester, someone like yourself, Paul, who is been editing and recording video for years. Like, I've been recovering video and photos for 20 years of my life and career. So when we can explain something, people get very hurt. Because this was an experience for them. But what I'd always try to explain is, A, you have contributed to the scientific process of this. You've contributed to the known quantitative, which only narrows further the actual phenomena. So you've contributed to the scientific process of investigating it. And at the same time, it does, even the explanation of what's inside your red circle on the picture or the film does not remove that moment of experience where you took the picture, where you had the question, and where something like pried the keyhole open with a crowbar for you to expand the lens through which you see the world, you know?
That's a great way to look at that, man. And I never belittle people for sending in photos and videos. And
same.
I respect everyone is out there doing it, man. And that's what it's all about. Let's all have a good time, respect our wild lands and wild places, and go solve some mysteries.
Well, and
go outside.
That's just it. Get outside and be safe, everybody. And, you know, thank you guys once again for coming on. The documentary is Wild Man, The Search for Lost Tribes and Feral Humans and primitive humanity. You can find that right there on Chester Moore on his YouTube channel. While you're there on YouTube, make sure to stop on by Wild Man of the Woods. That is Paul Fuzinski's YouTube channel there, folks. Also, make sure to visit darkoutdoors.com. That is the website of Chester's amazing and award-winning podcast, Dark Outdoors, as well as Higher Calling. That is where he does all of his wildlife reporting. That's where he has his mission to help children get out into the wild, all that kind of stuff. And of course, don't forget, while you're there, stopping by Curious Realm. CuriousRealm.com is where you can like, follow, subscribe, share. That's where you can find all of the YouTube channels of our guests. Thank you so much, everybody, for your time tonight. It is your open hearts, your open minds that make the conversation. And without conversation, humanity does not march forward. So remember, take care of yourselves, take care of each other, and stay curious. We'll talk to you soon. Bye-bye.
Thank you for tuning into this episode of The Curious Realm. Stay tuned for more guests, forbidden topics, and hidden truths. Follow us on social media by searching Curious Realm. To download the official Curious Realm app and view the Knowledge Vault, or become a sponsor of Curious Realm, visit our website at CuriousRealm.com. Curious Realm is available on your favorite podcast and video services, CuriousRealm.com, as well as KGRA Radio, APR TV, and the official Curious Realm app for Roku devices. Curious Realm is a proud member of the Ground Zero Media family of podcasts. For more shows and members-only content, visit groundzeroplus.com today. Thanks for listening. Stay curious. And remember, the other side is always watching.